Soon after the Federal Reserve began operation, it was apparent that local bankers sought to use these federal banks as a means of taking care of favorite sons. The Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia was known in the system as the Friends and Relatives Bank, and the head of one branch of the central bank was a man who never did a day's actual banking in his life. In another, both the governor and chairman had been the former heads of defunct banks. At this time, there were House hearings on stabilization of the purchasing power of the dollar. One of the hearings held in 1928 proved conclusively that the Federal Reserve Board worked in close cooperation with heads of European central banks, and that the depression of 1929 to 1931 was planned at a secret luncheon of the Federal Reserve Board and those heads of European central banks in 1927. And the reason for the secret meeting was how to get gold from the Federal Reserve Bank to the central banks in Europe. The board has never been made responsible to the public for its decisions or actions. But then, the Federal Reserve Board cannot be held liable because they are public officials who are appointed by the president, but their salaries are paid by the private stockholders of the Federal Reserve Banks. The constitutional checks and balances seem not to operate in finance. President Wilson and Carter Glass had both said the Federal Reserve Act would give the people of the United States a stable dollar. A provision for a stable dollar was put in the original bill by Senator Robert L. Owen, but Carter Glass had it struck out. Obviously, our monetary system was not stable like we were told it would be with the implementation of the Federal Reserve Act. In actuality, the heads of central banks of Europe and the United States did not want stability in their own currencies or in the price of gold. Businessmen did not want a stable dollar or stable commodity prices or stable securities. Instability is how the speculators and traders make profits. There was even a memorandum issued by the Federal Reserve Board on March 13, 1939, which stated that the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System oppose any bill which proposes a stable price level. An article in the North American Review by H. Parker Willis, who was one author of the Federal Reserve Act and first secretary of the board from 1914 to 1920, stated, "Since the inauguration of the Federal Reserve Act, we have suffered one of the most serious financial depressions and revolutions ever known in our history, that of 1920-1921. We have seen our agriculture pass through a long period of suffering and even of revolution, during which 1 million farmers left their farms due to difficulties with the price of land and the odd status of credit conditions. We have suffered the most extensive era of banking failures ever known in this country. 4,500 banks have closed their doors since the reserve system began functioning. In some western towns, there have been many times when all banks in that community failed, and even banks that have failed over and over again. There has been little difference in liability or failure between member and non-member banks of the Federal Reserve System. Before the stock market crash, a person could take $100 and through his broker borrow $900 at a bank and buy $1,000 of securities. This is called leverage. If the stock went up even a fraction, the purchaser could pay off the bank and double his investment after selling the stock. But the bank could, with a 24-hour notice, call the loan. In his book, The United States: Unresolved Monetary and Political Problems, William Bryan explains how the crisis that occurred in 1929 as follows. He said, when everything was ready, the New York financier started calling 24-hour broker call loans. This meant that the stockbrokers and the customers had to dump their stock on the market in order to pay the loans. This naturally collapsed the stock market and brought a banking collapse all over the country because the banks now owned by the oligarchy were heavily involved in broker call claims at this time. The bank runs soon exhausted their coins and currency, and they had to close. The Federal Reserve System would not come to their aid, although they were instructed under the law to maintain an elastic currency. The Federal Reserve did nothing to stimulate growth. It contracted the money supply and decreased it by more than one-third between 1929 and 1933. This gave no relief to the dying banks and helped sustain the depression. Economist Milton Friedman argues that the failure of the Federal Reserve to buy government bonds, which would have provided the banks with more cash and credit, precipitated the depression. When Black Thursday occurred on October 24, 1929, 5 days before Black Tuesday, the bankers scurried into the offices of J.P. Morgan, just like they had done in 1907. This time, George Harrison, the governor of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, was in attendance. The bankers formed a pool, and Richard Whitney, a Morgan banker, sauntered into the floor of the stock market and bought large chunks of stock. The market rallied, but dropped again the following Monday, and the bankers assembled again at Morgan's library. This time, Harrison of the Federal Reserve bought huge amounts of government bonds from the banks, and this allowed the stock market to stay open. But the next year, the Bank of the United States, not the Federal Bank as the century before, faced a run of withdrawals, and the other New York bankers refused to rescue it. This resulted in the biggest bank failures in American history. A panic followed, and in 1 month, 325 banks failed in this country. We had another crisis in 1931 and in 1933. Between 1929 and 1933, the number of banks had dropped from 25,000 to 18,000. On October 31, 1932, the governor of Nevada ordered a 12-day banking holiday. On February the 4th, the governor of Louisiana, Huey P. Long, closed all banks. On the 16th of February, the governor of Michigan closed them for a week. On March the 4th, 1933, Governor Hubert H. Lehman closed New York banks for 2 days. And during the very dark years of 1930 and 1931, the Federal Reserve Board could have acted to relieve the plight of the people, but they did not. People printed their own money on wood and paper for use in their own communities, and this money was good since it represented obligations to each other, which the people fulfilled. Hoover had a plan to help the banking industry, but he also was a Republican with a Democratic Congress, which would not back the plan. When Hoover became a lame duck president, he appealed to Roosevelt to issue a statement which would gather congressional support for the plan. Roosevelt did not reply. He later claimed that he had written one but did not send it because of an oversight. The banks kept collapsing right up to FDR's inauguration. As soon as Roosevelt was inaugurated, he announced the emergency banking measures. This was the exact plan Hoover's Treasury Secretary had drawn up. Franklin Delano Roosevelt's political career was due to fortuitous circumstances. Eustace Mullins tells us that as Assistant Secretary of the Navy during World War I, because of old school ties, he had intervened to prevent prosecution of a large ring of homosexuals in the Navy, which included several Croton and Harvard chums. This brought him to the favorable attention of a wealthy international homosexual set which traveled back and forth between New York and Paris and which was presided over by Bessie Marbury. She was of a very old and prominent New York family. Bessie's wife, who lived with her for a number of years, was Elsie DeWolf, later Lady Mendel, because of a marriage of convenience, and she became the arbiter of the international set. They recruited J.P. Morgan's youngest daughter, Ann Morgan, into their circle and used her fortune to restore the Villa Trianon in Paris, which became their headquarters. During World War I, it was used as a hospital. Bessie Marbury expected to be awarded the Legion of Honor by the French government as a reward, but J.P. Morgan Jr., who despised her for corrupting his youngest sister, requested the French government to withhold the award, which they did. Smarting from this rebuff, Bessie Marbury threw herself into politics and became a power in the Democratic National Party. She had also recruited Eleanor Roosevelt into her circle, and during a visit to Hyde Park, Eleanor confided that she was desperate to find something for poor Franklin to do, as he was confined to a wheelchair and very depressed. "I know what we'll do," exclaimed Bessie. "We'll run him for governor of New York." Because of her power, she succeeded in this goal, and Roosevelt, of course, later became president. Roosevelt was elected in 1932, and in 1932, this was the year we had the largest vote for collectivist politicians. The total vote was less than 3%, less than 1 out of 40. Roosevelt's campaign in 1932 promised an end to reckless spending. Special favors to selected groups would cease. Squandering of federal income on discredited economic panaceas would be stopped. Overlapping federal bureaus would be consolidated. Useless bureaus would be eliminated. Economy and administration would be inaugurated. The national budget would be balanced. The dangerous trend towards centralization of authority at Washington would be arrested. The forgotten man would be remembered, and the power of government transferred from the privileged few to the hands of all the people. Well, Roosevelt was inaugurated on March 4, 1933. On March 5th, he closed all banks for 4 days. Roosevelt's campaign pledges flew south like ducks in autumn. Reckless expenditures increased to heights previously unknown in the nation's peacetime history. Taxes paid by all the people were poured out into unearned bounties to special groups. Discredited economic panaceas won favor and new defenders. All pretense at balancing the budget was abandoned, and a stupendous debt piled up to crush the people and their children by future taxation. Experienced advisors were dismissed, and clever young radicals replaced them. Roosevelt also kept some of the old standbys, too. During his campaign, Roosevelt promised radical social changes when he took office. But when he took office as President of the United States, he appointed as Director of the Budget James Paul Warburg, son of Paul Warburg and Vice President of the International Acceptance Bank and other corporations. W. H. Woods was appointed Secretary of the Treasury. He was one of the biggest industrialists in the country. He was later replaced by Henry Morgenthau, Jr., son of the Harlem real estate operator who had helped Woodrow Wilson into the White House. With a crew like this, Roosevelt's promise of radical social changes showed little likelihood of fulfillment. Between 1933 and 1935, Roosevelt reduced private indebtedness and increased public indebtedness. There's a saying that the bank takes tax money from poor people in rich nations and gives to rich people in poor nations. To make matters worse, many of the social reforms that the bank was funding involved fostering the spread of socialism and communism. This means he eased the burden of debts of the rich onto the poor. It is no secret that the international bankers profiteer from sovereign state debt. The New York banks have found important profit centers in the lending to countries plunged into debt by socialist regimes. Under socialist regimes, countries go deeper and deeper into debt because socialism as an economic system does not work. International bankers are sophisticated enough to understand this phenomena, and they are sophisticated enough to profit from it. Because the public debt is a sovereign debt, the bankers have calculated that they will always be able to collect. If there is too much risk in the private debt side, it is a simple matter to get socialist governments to nationalize banks, industrial enterprises, and agricultural holdings. The Bank of England was nationalized in 1946. Before it was nationalized, the stockholders received about 12% on their investments annually. After it was nationalized, the stockholders received about 12% on their return annually. In this way, private debt is converted into sovereign state debt, which the bankers believe will always be collectible. The New York banks find the profit from the interest on this sovereign debt to be critical to their balance sheets. Up until very recently, this has been an essentially risk-free game for the bankers because the International Monetary Fund and World Bank have stood ready to bail the banks out with taxpayers' money. Some of the first policies Roosevelt enacted was recognition of the Soviet Union and taking us off the gold standard. In 1933, President Roosevelt and Congress called in all the gold at a loss to the stockholders of gold currency and gold bonds of about 40%, amounting to approximately $5 billion. This $5 billion went to the new owners of the gold known in the United States as the individual owners of the Federal Reserve System, who own and control all of the gold and most of the silver of the world, which they have deposited not only in Fort Knox, but all over the world in their strong boxes. Then Roosevelt arbitrarily raised the price of gold from $20 per ounce to $35 per ounce. There is not a government in the world, including the USA, who owns even a small part of the gold. Roosevelt then created the Export-Import Bank and enacted the National Recovery Administration, also known as the NRA. The NRA collaborated with big business to set prices, wages, and working conditions. The big companies could dictate the standards in their respective fields and strangle small competitors. This plan had been given to Hoover when he was president, and he refused. In his memoirs, he wrote, "Among the early Roosevelt fascist measures was the National Industry Recovery Act, the NRA. The origins of this scheme were worth repeating. These ideas were first suggested by Gerard Swope. Following his, they were adopted by the United States Chamber of Commerce. During the campaign of 1932, Henry I. Harriman, president of that body, urged that I agree to support these proposals, informing me that Mr. Roosevelt had agreed to do so. I tried to show that this stuff was pure fascism, that it was merely a remaking of Mussolini's corporate state, and refused to do any of it. He informed me that in view of my attitude, the business world would support Roosevelt with money and influence. That, for the most part, proved true. Everything was structured under the NRA. Jack Magid, a New Jersey tailor, was fined and thrown in jail for charging 35 cents to press a suit when the NRA code stipulated 40 cents. War was waged against the evils of business and against private enterprise itself. As soon as he was in office, the new president recommended a series of drastic but temporary measures, and Congress rapidly adopted them. In order to act with greater efficiency, he asked for unprecedented grants of powers, and these powers Congress placed in his hands. Instead of consolidating and eliminating federal bureaus, they were multiplied in number and magnified in authority. The government was not decentralized and returned to the people. It was transferred to a vast bureaucracy in Washington controlled by one man. Power granted by the people for the duration of an emergency was not returned to the people when the emergency ended. Fundamental changes to the people's government were effected without the people's consent. No gold or silver was allowed to leave the country. Roosevelt and Henry Morgenthau, Secretary of the Treasury, set the daily price of gold. Thereafter, each day, Morgenthau and Roosevelt met with Jesse Jones, head of the RFC. These three met to fix the price of gold. They gathered around Roosevelt's bed in the morning as he ate his eggs. Then, Morgenthau and Roosevelt decided the price of gold for that particular day. One day they wished to raise the price. Different prices for the increase were discussed, but Roosevelt settled the point. Make it 21 cents, he ruled. That is a lucky number, 3 times 7, and so it was done. That night, Morgenthau wrote in his diary, "If people knew how we fixed the price of gold, they would be frightened." Earl Long gave some advice to his older brother Huey, who at that time was the governor of Louisiana. He said, "Don't write anything you can phone. Don't phone anything you can talk. Don't talk anything you can whisper. Don't whisper anything you can smile. Don't smile anything you can nod. Don't nod anything you can wink." See, Earl had also been governor of Louisiana. In a 1934 pamphlet, Huey Long stated that 600 families owned twice as much as all the balance of the people put together. 4% of the people own 87% of the wealth of this country. Huey Long put into congressional records of January 23, 1935. Under Hoover, the national debt figure was $19,487,000,000. On December 31, 1934, the national deficit had been raised to $28,478,000,000, which was an increase of approximately $9 billion, and most of it was just that much more debt. Huey Long also put into the congressional record of January 14, 1935, that 60% of the money in the banks was owned by 2/3 of 1% of the population. There were 1 million more people out of work in 1935 as compared to 1934, and 34.5 million more families were on the dole in 1935 as opposed to 1934. The national debt was $26 billion at the end of World War I. In 1935, it had climbed to $28.5 billion. In 1929, which was the beginning of Hoover's depression, the farm population was 30,257,000, and they earned $11,941,000,000, or $394 for every farm person. In 1933, the farm population increased by 2 million up to 32,500,000, who earned for the whole year $6,256,000,000 less. $271 billion of this $6 million was given to the people by the government, or the sum of $184 per person. So the average farm person only got 46% as much under FDR as a farm person got under Hoover's first depression year. Figuring that every employed person was the breadwinner of 1.5 to 5 people, we come up with the figure that 1/2 the population in 1934 was unemployed. Wages increased 6.7% in 1934 over 1933. food prices increased 11.3% during the same period. House furnishings rose 15.3% during the same period. So, while the average employed worker's income increased, his standard of living decreased. The average worker's income was 43% below the poverty level in 1934. In 1934, we had too much to eat, too much to wear, too many houses to live in, and too many automobiles to be sold. The only trouble was, too few controlled the money and the wealth, and too many did not have the money with which to buy the things they needed for life and comfort. The wealth of the United States was 3 times greater in 1910 than it was in 1890, but the masses of the people owned less in 1910 than they did in 1890. In 1916, Congress provided a committee which reported that 2% of the people owned 60% of the wealth of the country, and 65% of the people owned less than 5% of the wealth. The so-called middle class owned 35% of the wealth. At that time, the middle class consisted of 33% of the people. This showed that 2% of the people owned twice as much as all the remainder of the people put together, and 65% of the people owned practically nothing at all. But in 1930, 1% of the people owned about 59% of the wealth, which was almost twice as bad as what it was said to be in tolerable conditions in 1916. By 1934, it was estimated that 75% of the people owned nothing at all. 4%, or maybe less than 4%, owned 85 to 90% of all the wealth in the United States. We repeat and respectfully submit that in view of the foregoing facts, it is clearly established that Hungary did not cause and did not bring about World War I. The responsibility rests solely upon the shoulders of the international financiers. It is they upon whose head the blood of millions of dying rest. That's a quotation from Senate Committee Report number 346. After the First World War, Germany was devastated by reparations it had to pay to France, England, and the United States. Russia was in economic chaos following the Revolution. England and France were impoverished. Sir Montague Norman became head of the Bank of England and remained so for the next 20 years. Emile Mouroux was the top dog at the Bank of France, and Benjamin Strong represented the Federal Reserve System of the United States. When the First World War ended, a destitute Adolf Hitler was given an assignment by German Army Intelligence to watch a tiny political group called the German Workers' Party. He attended a small meeting where Gottfried Federer's monetary views made a very deep impression on him. According to the book, The Lost Science of Money, which I've told you about before, Federer's monetary views may have come from the book The State Theory of Money by George Knapp, written in 1905. Knapp stated that money is a creation of law, and what makes money good is that it will be accepted in payments made to the state offices. Hitler came to power on January 30, 1933. Germany's foreign exchange at that time and gold reserves had dropped from 2.6 billion marks in 1929 to 409 million in 1933 and to only 83 million marks in late 1934. According to logical economic theory, Germany was broke and would have to borrow their money. But Germany had other ideas. We'll talk about Germany's other ideas on our next program. Join us then, and thanks for listening. So long.